Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Troy Noons is an Absolute Podcast. I'm your host, as always, John Casillo, and with me today is Dan Lyons.
Hello, everyone. Happy we beat Pitt for the second time in like 15 years week.
Yeah. We can has football.
Yes, and it only took like a very disappointing Pitt team that we've been ragging on all season.
That we still could have potentially lost.
Oh yeah, I mean we only won by three. It wasn't like a definitive like blow. I think it was like probably a little. I know the numbers don't totally bat this up, at least Bill C's numbers, but I thought it felt like more of a decisive win than the score indicated. But it was still a 3-point win. But a 3-point win or a 30-point win against Pitt, whatever, I don't care. Just get it, and we did. So that was good.
Well, to be honest, like this game had like the dumbest bell curve ever. Where it like started off probably on like near the highest point. Obviously, it would have been at the highest point if we had not, you know, canceled out. Because to be honest, like that was a touchdown by Ishmael, whatever. So should have started at the highest point. Then this like really deep valley, and then it seemed like every drive after like the second one, we got better and better each drive, and then it like just kind of peaked from the last drive of the second quarter on. And we're seeing a lot of that, I think, throughout the year. That's good in some ways because it shows that once we're on, we're on. But it's bad in others because we do have this like large valley, and that's where a lot of teams start to put some distance between them and us, and it puts too much pressure on the defense.
Yeah, and like you said, that almost seemed to be the case here in the second quarter when Pitt scored those. You know, they jumped out ahead a little bit, and I was quite nervous, but luckily. I just think we were overall the better team and were able to hold on, especially with, again, another big third quarter, which seems to be the pattern here for us, and a really nice performance by Dungy, who I think Pro Football Focus had as their ACC QB of the week for, what, the second time this year?
Second or third, maybe? No love from the ACC, but that's not surprising.
Yeah, whatever. Like, it is what it is. Actually, like, and there were some other like, nice indicators. I thought... Obviously, the numbers are still not great, but I thought we ran the ball more effectively than we have.
Oh, absolutely.
I know 3.2 yards a carry, still not great. The fact that I didn't realize Strickland carried the ball 25 times, which is kind of remarkable considering like it didn't feel like that, but it seemed like we found some things that could at least string together like 3 yards versus like some of the other, I think 3.2 is probably not that far off what our season average is, but... Those were like, we'd break a big one, or Dungy would pick up a bunch, and then everyone else would be at like 1 or 2 yards. And this, you know, it seemed like if we really needed a couple like yards to pick up a first down or something, we could kind of get it. And I don't know what Pitt's, I'm not, you know, that aware of what Pitt's like front seven situation is. I know their defense overall is not very good. But the fact that we were finally able to like get a mediocre to subpar running game felt good considering what the rest of the season and what, you know, most of last year was like.
Well, I think a lot of it, too, is that, you know, and we mentioned this in some of the articles and on Slack, like, we just weren't running it right up the gut either, I think, which was a big plus. We were, you know, kind of varying things. You know, 2 weeks ago, we were doing some Devin Butler jet sweeps. That seemed to get, I think, teams a little off the trail of running it up the gut, I think. In this one, we seemed to do a little more off tackle. I think Strickland did a better job of following his blocks. We used Elmore better as a blocker. Even if I think he declined as a runner in terms of his effectiveness in that game. And again, like then the fact that that set up a really great game from Ravion Pierce, you know, getting behind the line, who was sucked in to try to make sure that they weren't giving up 3-4 yard chunks at a time to Dante Strickland. Like all that worked together really well and started putting together some semblance of what this offense was supposed to be under Babers to begin with and is only now starting to look like it.
Yeah, and I think we're starting to see, you know, maybe a delayed timeline compared to what Babers brought up when he got the job, but, like, it does seem like we are starting to fill in here in the middle of the season, and we can get, like, a pretty, you know, we understand what the performance we're going to get on a week-to-week basis from this offense is. Now, that might get totally thrown off this week with Clemson, and they're just absolutely nasty, ferocious defense, but honestly, like, I'm going to struggle to really take a lot away from the Clemson game just because they're so good and they're at a different level than pretty much anyone else we'll face this year, including NC State, who has a very good defense that we, you know, had some success again. I'm going to probably not be able to overreact too much to the Clemson game no matter what because, like, that team on defense especially is so good. if they blank us, like, I honestly don't think it's a huge deal. Obviously, I don't want that, and I'll, you know, that it's easy to say now. Maybe when I watch the game on Friday night, I'll be a little more worked up. But overall, I think this game we had to take with, like, a huge grain of salt, no matter what happens.
Unless we win.
Then,
yeah.
If we win, then we can, like, pour all the salt out and just, you know, there'll be other salt. It will not be the type that I'm talking about. It will be the Twitter type where someone goes and finds, like, James Slater's house and, like, exit or whatever. But overall, like, I don't expect, this will probably be a blip in the constant, like, you know, improvement of the offense here.
Nonetheless, half the fan base is going to overreact.
Oh, I mean, I have no doubt about that. They'll overreact no matter what. Like, Syracuse will lose by one, and people will, you know, lose their minds about how, you know, the program is heading in the wrong direction.
I mean, I know you saw some of the conversations I was, like, involved in. I just started muting people during the game. Because, like, I mean, I'm not going to defend everything that this team does, and I've actively criticized week after week certain decision-making, like, issues, but overall, like, it's indisputable that you can see progress on a week-to-week standpoint from a competitive standpoint. It's very obvious that, like, there's a small, like, the disconnect is at the offensive line, and if that gets fixed, 90% of the problems are gone on the offensive end. Like,
and that's where we're doing our best recruiting.
Like, exactly. Like, so to me, like, the progress, it might not be perfectly linear, but you're definitely seeing it go up. And especially, again, with a defense that has improved beyond even, like, what you and I know you and I were saying, like, a great season would be if we improved to, like, somewhere around 80th defensively. And I think we're probably going to finish somewhere around 60th to 70th defensively instead. Like, this group and based on the play of a lot of young guys, this group has gotten considerably better in just a year. And I know I've mentioned this in the comments and elsewhere too. Like, credit to Brian Ward for Dino Babers for letting Brian Ward really do what he needed to do, for understanding that you weren't going to be able to fit a bunch of square pegs into round holes right away. You could take concepts of the Tampa 2, apply them to the concepts from the previous regime in spurts, and then to help that out, go out and get players who can apply pressure. So I think we're seeing kind of a hybrid Tampa 2, and one that, again, it's not perfect, but it does really, it bends a whole lot more than it breaks, and that's not something most of Scott Schaefer's later defenses could even say.
Yeah, I think we've gotten, like you said, we always said, like, getting the defense into, like, the 80s, and right now it's hovering around 60s with some numbers that are even better, like our, like, stop rate and everything else. And honestly, like, if we could start getting more, you know, sacks and big plays, I think we would really see a step up. But for now, I think we've improved probably more than either of us would have expected was reasonably possible. And I think if not for, you know, one horrible performance against MTSU and, you know, the offense maybe not taking the step, you know, I don't know if the offense is worse. I just don't think it's taken quite the step forward we thought yet. And it might still, because it's early in the year, you know, we're at midseason roughly. There could still be improvement on that end. But overall, like, I think you have to be pretty pleased with where things are going. Like, this is a better team than last year. This is better than, honestly, like, this team is probably better than the 2013 team that, you know.
Oh, it is, without a doubt.
Used a pretty advantageous schedule to go to a mediocre bowl, which I would love. I would sign for the Texas Bowl in a minute right now. But this is a better team. This is probably better than any of the Schaefer teams. It's better than probably the two non-bowl Maroon teams. It has an identity on both sides of the ball, like you said. It's just, you know, we need an insertion of talent. The offensive line is a huge issue that is, you know, is being worked on. Like, look at our recruiting list. We have one of the three best centers in the country coming in, and he seems rock solid on his commitment. Fingers crossed, knock on wood, whatever else. So All-American at that. So, like, I think there are issues, and like you said, we both, like, criticize Babers during games all the time for individual calls, and that's a fair thing to do, because when you're watching a football game, like, no coach has perfect games. It just doesn't happen. If you're a Patriots fan, you can criticize Bill Belichick for decisions. That doesn't mean that you are saying that he shouldn't be the coach anymore because he had one, you know, bad stretch of plays or you didn't like one key decision. Like, I think Babers has made a number of mistakes throughout these games. It doesn't mean that overall I'm not very happy with where things are going. So people seem to have this, like, weird thing where you know, you have one bad, you know, series, or you know, there's a bad call on a fourth down, a fourth and one, and you think it was a stupid play call, and all of a sudden you want to burn the house down. Like, yo, just step back. We won the game. We're going to we've seen, you know, pretty sizable improvement from year one to year two, even if the record isn't going to end up indicating it because of how tough this schedule is. We happen to draw Miami, who looks really good, et cetera, et cetera. We had LSU. Like, there's just a lot here that I just wish people were better at taking a step back. Because overall, I think it's hard to really knock what Babers has done thus far. I think we've taken pretty manageable, realistic steps, and hopefully this continues to pay off at the end of the year and heading into next year.
Yeah, I mean, what I do appreciate about Babers is that he's not skipping steps. Like, we added JUCO guys. We added JUCO guys to fix certain issues and let guys come along behind them. I do see a lot of naysayers on Babers, despite, like, do you really think, like, if these people, like, some of them go, I didn't like Scott Schaefer either. Like, okay, so what do you want? And again, like, I don't want to go down this rabbit hole, but it's indisputable that there's progress. Maybe it's not enough for some people, but it should be. And if you've waited this long, you know, 15 years or so, I think you can wait a little bit longer. I know I can. One interesting thing, and we've mentioned Bill C's numbers here and there on today's show already. What I found most interesting is that this team really still hasn't performed super well in any games except for the Central Michigan game and the Central Connecticut State game, and nonetheless has come really close. I mean, they obviously beat Pitt, despite performing at an under 50% percentile of what they could have done. They came within single digits of three separate teams while performing at, you know, sub 40% clips, I believe. Like, even the LSU game, I think, was like 38. I don't have it in front of me, but I think that was 38. And the NC State game was around like 35, something like that. Like,
this is like worse, 32 and 28.
That's what I mean. Like, so on the bad side, we have a team performing under what it could. On the other side, though, like, this team is within single digits of ranked opponents while performing well underneath its ceiling. So to me, I don't know. I guess I see that as a positive, and I see that as a great sign for things going forward, especially given how many young players are on the roster.
Yeah, it just seems like we're in games this year where we might not have been last year. We played NC State and LSU, who are both roughly top 30 programs, probably a little better, honestly. To games that we could have won, even without playing our A game. Like you said, it's not like we're going out and overperforming and dropping these games. Like, we are playing about the amount, we're playing about as well as you would imagine we would in losing to NC State by 8 points versus, like, going and playing this incredible game and losing to NC State by 8 points. So while I would love for our team to max out what they're doing every week, like, that's unrealistic. And, you know, hopefully we get one of those, like, awesome performances down the road where everything clicks like it did for the Virginia Tech game last year, and we can score one of these unexpected wins.
Maybe Clemson. Which would,
maybe.
Not Clemson, but I mean, I'm not saying that there's no chance in hell, but there's minimal chance in hell, much less chance than the Virginia Tech game. That said, if SU wants to put together a once-in-a-lifetime performance on Friday, go for it.
I'm here for it. I mean, I'd be fine with it. What's it been, 33 years since Nebraska? So,
yes.
I feel like we're overdue.
Yeah, I'd say that's fair. I guess a little bit more on, well, I think it's just the midseason stuff. Dan, do you feel like 3-3 is about where we were going to be at this point? I know I mentioned kind of in my, like, takeaways post on Sunday, I was saying, like, I feel like we'd feel differently about this 3-3 if you swap the Middle Tennessee and Pitt games. But overall, like, yes, we should be 4-2, if not better. But I'm not gonna sit here and try to claim that, like, we're vastly underperforming where we should, because I don't, again, based on everything I've said so far in this podcast, I don't believe that's true at all.
Yeah, I think you could buy 4-2. Like, we were both lower on Pitt entering the year than most people, but I think they're worse than we even thought they would be.
Yeah.
And again, we kind of snuck by them. MTSU is a game they should have won. They should have won considering what's happened since. It was just a really bad performance. They fell on their face that day. There's no real excuse for it. Overall, like, otherwise, though, you could have easily talked yourself into winning that game and losing to Pitt, because we always lose to Pitt. And then, yeah, you'd probably be about here. I think we both probably felt a little better about Pitt. But at the same time, we probably didn't think NC State, I mean, we definitely didn't think NC State was going to be quite this good, and we almost beat them. We lost by a touchdown on the road. So I'd say 3-3 to 4-2 was the expectation, depending on how optimistic you are, and we are right there.
Agreed. Yeah, I mean, I will never understand what everybody's waiting for, looking for at this point, but it happens. Any performances for you, individual player-wise, stick out so far? We guess we could start with the offense, and feel free to avoid the obvious ones. Is there anybody kind of, you know, under the radar that's really impressed you at this juncture?
I'd say if we're avoiding, like, the normal, like, Ishmael Phillips, obviously I think Steve has probably exceeded our expectations, even though we had pretty high ones. We had pretty high ones his entire career. Considering this last game, I was really excited to see some of these younger guys step up. It was obviously kind of the Devin Butler and Raven Pierce show. They both had breakout games. And obviously, you know, Ishmael had a 5 for 97 and a touchdown. He had a great game and made some unbelievable plays. But Pierce and Butler combined for 16 catches. Butler scored that awesome touchdown.
Oh, that was great. It was perfect ball, too.
Awesome throw, awesome catch. It was really nice to see those guys get involved. Not that Ishmael and Phillips were quiet. Like, they both had really nice games themselves. But I think it's important that we get more than just those two options going. And they both made, you know, pretty big impacts. Pierce, I think, finally avoided having, like, a debilitating foul penalty called on him, which was like a trend on him throughout the entire season. And then he also had his best game as a receiver. Butler obviously showed some game-breaking ability. I think we're all high on him. So those two, especially with this last game, coming into account, because before this, like, the running game is kind of hard to talk about too much, even if it was slightly improved this week. And then Ishmael and Phillips are just obvious. So I'm going to go with those two guys, considering where we are coming off the Pitt game.
Fair. Let's see. You went with Ishmael and Phillips. I'm going to go with... I wish it could be Riley, but, like, other than that one game, he hasn't really done much.
I mean, special teams, so...
Special teams he has, although at the same time, like, the team's been kicking away from him for weeks now.
Yeah, although that you know, presents its own opportunities where you're starting at, like, the 30 a lot. And the power turns have gotten better since the first couple weeks.
They have, actually. I'm going to go with somebody. I kind of think it's Butler, to be honest. Like, I know it hasn't been consistent, and we've definitely leaned on, you know, Phillips and Ishmael for a bunch of time, but I'm willing to give it to Butler because he's been so versatile. I mean, he had one game where he threw a touchdown pass. He had another game where we were just running him with jet sweep. We had another one where he was playing in Irv Phillips type position. And this one, he was being tried out as a deep guy. He's oddly like our best, I think, jack of all trades. And he's just a very good athlete and a player that we've been able to, you know, insert in a lot of different places. And I think his versatility has really paid off this year. Because again, and this is something that like has been true since day one this season. We don't have a certifiable deep threat. People might get fooled into thinking that we do after last game. But remember, like, Pitt's safeties are god-awful. And, like, Ishmael abused Maddox all game on Saturday. Like, that was not what you're going to see against teams like Clemson. It's not even what you're going to see against teams like Wake Forest. Like, we're not going to get the one-on-one matchups like... Said, we mentioned the ball that Dungy threw to Butler. I believe it was about 32, 33-yard touchdown in the second half. Like, you're not going to get a whole lot of those. I mean, you saw how late the safety was to breaking over to the pass. Like, that wasn't like a once-in-a-lifetime throw, but that was not a throw that you're going to get against the upper echelon of the ACC or any, like, pretty good opponent. It's one you're going to get against a bad team like Pitt, who, again, like, even Narduzzi said before the game, he was hoping that SU would attack, you know, Pitt's corners, and you know, because they're just better athletes than who they had at safety. But it didn't really seem to matter, no matter what. But it's, yeah, especially the safeties, I mean, we had him over the top, you know, three or four different times. There was that one ball that was almost picked That if Dungy had just, and we can talk about this too before halftime, but if Dungy had just put the ball a little bit out ahead, that would have been about a 45, 50-yard touchdown catch for Ishmael. I mentioned this in the play calling article, but it did seem, and I don't know if you noticed too, that like Dungy just seemed like supremely off in the first like 20 or so throws, and then suddenly something clicked. I don't know what it was. I don't know what he changed, but something suddenly clicked, and he was delivering everything on the money. He wasn't short. He wasn't high. Everything suddenly seemed like it was crisp. And I'm not sure what the hell was going on for the first 20 or so throws.
No, he definitely seemed off. I think a number of people tweeted about it. He was sailing throws. He was throwing them. He was way off target, which honestly, like, it was might have been for the best because, you know, when you're a little bit off target, you might end up throwing right at a defender where he was just, like, so far off, it didn't matter. He was sailing balls out of bounds.
Let's put him on the ground, too. We ended up losing out the first down with Irv on that, like, third or fourth drive because Dungy put it almost on the ground. Irv caught it, but he caught it still, like, half a yard short of the marker. If he delivered it on the chest, and the same goes for the third and 12 throw when we were near the goal line toward the end of the game. If he had put that on Pierce's chest, and this is when I started seeing things go back the other way. If he put that ball on Pierce's chest, Pierce gets the first down and maybe even touchdown. And if he just throws it normally to Pierce in the last play, Pierce probably gets the first down.
But then after that, I think I saw you tweet it. Didn't Dungy have like a ridiculous stretch of like completions in a row?
17 for 18. And the only incompletion was a drop.
Yeah, I wasn't sure. I was looking now on the ESPN bot store, but as we know, the ESPN bot store can tell you lies and deceit. So
that it can.
That's really impressive. Yeah, he definitely bounced back, even without like looking at the numbers that closely. But it was rough for a bit. And he has those halves sometimes where he just looks like he's off target. And at least he does a nice job of correcting himself because he doesn't seem to have put together like terrible games. Like occasionally he'll have bad stretches and he'll have stretches where he just is perfect. But he seems to have a good job of like putting away a couple bad drives and turning the corner where other quarterbacks might just bury themselves in a hole and have like a really awful overall game.
Well, he does have, and this is bad for some players, but for him, I don't think so. The irrational confidence thing where Dungy is he's not super cocky, but he does have that irrational confidence in himself that like leads to every good thing and every like not as good thing about Dungy all at once.
Yeah. It's where you see him. Was it this game where he jumped over the line to gain like a yard, even though it was third and 10 or something, and there was no chance of him picking up the first down?
It's like, you didn't need to do that.
Yeah, it's like, just throw it away, Eric. Yeah, he, like, hurdled a guy for literally no reason and almost broke, like, his own ankles or someone else's. We always talk about, like, you take the good with the bad with Dungy, and I think, for the most part, we get way more good.
He's become a much smarter runner this year, to be honest.
Like, yes,
he has been. Week to week, he's getting better.
Yeah, I feel like it's been like 2 or 3 weeks since he took like a big unnecessary shot. Now, like occasionally when you're running, like you will get big hits, even legal ones, and there's only so much you can do. It feels like it's been probably since week 2 or 3 that he's taken like a really nasty one that had me concerned.
I was concerned about the one in the LSU game that he didn't get, that they didn't call, but then they made a makeup call later. They did it in this one too a little bit, where he slid, they didn't call it. And then, like, admittedly, he slides late, so, like, I get why they're not calling it. And then, like, a play later or so, they call
it. I forgot about that one where it looked like he was down and they came in with the second guy, and I kind of lost my mind. But either way, like, he got right up. It wasn't, like, a thing where you thought he might be concussed or he might be out.
Oh, yeah.
So definitely getting better in that regard, which is nice because that's, like, obviously been our main concern with Dungy for 3 years now.
One place he's not getting better, and again, this is not to, like, just rag on Dungy because, to be honest, he's our best offensive player. It's more just I was talking to people about this in the comments, the free play nonsense, where I feel like just about every free play that Dungy's ever had has been an interception. Because, like, he takes free play to mean, doesn't matter what happens, no consequences.
And then you have, like, 4 offsetting penalties, and you're like, oh, maybe this wasn't, like, the best thing that we could have done with this. And I'm also a fan of the Green Bay Packers, and Aaron Rodgers is maybe the best free play quarterback ever.
Yes, 100%.
So it's definitely a little bit jarring, but yeah, I feel like he's thrown probably 3 or 4 interceptions on free plays over the last couple of years.
Minimum. Like, he threw one in this game. The other one went out the back of the end zone. like completely. He had, I mean, there was a free play. He did do a good job on the free play to Ishmael, but then that got canceled out. But yeah, I can recall 3 to 4 just off the top of my head of just plays that he just said, nah, F it. And then like, and just launches it up into like a crowd. Like, if you have a check, like, yeah, you should go deep, but if you have a check down open 10, 15 yards down the field while there's like, if there's four defenders crowded around the receiver you're throwing to, somebody's open, somebody else is open.
Yeah, and also like, and this isn't his fault, but college football refs, I don't trust all that much.
No.
So like, while you're usually pretty sure that you have a free play because you can see a die jump, I'm always a little nervous that they called something else.
He's even banked on it. Like once he threw an interception after, like, and he banked on it, and then after it didn't happen, then he just had a pick. I remember. Yeah. I don't remember what game that was. I was furious.
Yeah, you have to be pretty certain. And again, like, I'm spoiled because I watch Rodgers throw. I feel like he throws for like 3 or 4 touchdowns a year on free plays, just because he has some weird like zen-like knowledge that his receiver is going to get, you know, the hot route and go deep on it. But mostly Jordy Nelson, because they have they're basically Jedi. Like they just have some weird mind melt. But Dungy does not quite have that with any of his players yet, and most quarterbacks don't. So yeah, I think there are probably worse bad habits, but it does make me nervous, like almost once every 2 games at this point.
Agreed. The one thing I will say though, and this is kind of related back to his running before we get to halftime, the dude really does have, like, again, him getting better as a runner and smarter as a runner. He has a brass pair sometimes, and that 20-yard run towards the end of the fourth quarter was like a prime example of like him just willing himself to a bigger game than he should have had by any means.
Yeah, and thank God for it, because he's like, again, still our only consistent running game. And if not for Dungy being able to pick up like 6 yards of carry when he breaks contain, we would have very little reason for defenses to keep to stay honest. So he is, like, obviously Ishmael's amazing and Phillips is great. Dungy is so important to this team, and while like there are criticisms as we've laid out, he's just like, this team would be absolutely buried on offense without him, and we're very lucky to have him, because he is the best quarterback we've had in a long time. And like, I look forward to seeing where his numbers are at the end of the year, because like right now he's on pace for like 35 total touchdowns and probably roughly 4,000 total yards. So he's putting together quite the campaign, and hopefully he starts to get a little more national recognition, because he's a super fun player to watch. And I feel like he gets some from like some of the national people, but it's easy to ignore Syracuse, and hopefully we get to a place where, you know, next year, if we hopefully start to peak and contend for bowls and whatnot, he gets some looks, because he's, you know, really one of the most fun players, even if, you know, there's a dozen or two better quarterbacks in the country. Like,
yeah, that's the thing. It's the fun factor with him, that like he's just an entertaining player to watch, because he enjoys what he's doing, and he's getting smarter on the fearless front. But like, he's a fun player to watch, and anyone who's watched one Syracuse game could tell you that. It's just interesting how like you see these fun quarterbacks at places like Utah State and elsewhere in the last few years that like people gravitate towards and know about. But like Dungy, I feel like there's not a whole lot of folks with him on their radars. And that's weird, especially given like there are a decent amount of alums at ESPN and other outlets. Like, you would think that there'd be, like, David Hale talks about him, also an alum, but like there's very few people like openly talking about Dungy on a week to week or every other week basis.
Yeah, it's unfortunate, because he I think he definitely deserves better. Hopefully next year, entering his senior year, you know, assuming he is still at Syracuse, I don't really know why he wouldn't be, considering how the season's gone, but just assuming he's still here, hopefully then he'll start to get some plaudits, like, you know, some of those lesser school quarterbacks that you I think you were hitting at Chucky Keaton, who was at Utah State and got hurt pretty much every year. A weird comp for Dungy, like a weirdly accurate comp for Dungy so far, unfortunately. But like, he was the one, like, he's a similar player where fearless, puts together crazy numbers, kind of carries the offense on his shoulders. Hopefully at the end of this year we'll kind of get that going into 2018.
Yes, please. Dan, let's do a little halftime before we jump into the rest of this.
Sounds good. I am actually going to have to, like, sit out at halftime because I was, you know, fighting off a cold that I was dealing with this time last week. So I really didn't drink much of anything. I had some drinks, but I don't think I had anything new on the beer front. So I'm leaving the floor to you.
Fair enough. I didn't have much to drink either. So
good halftime, everyone.
Yeah. I did go down to my wife was out of town. So when she was out of town, I really didn't do much but watch college football and save my drinking till after I'm done writing. I got a growler of a Monkish double IPA, Water Balloon Fighters. So had that. Had a bottle of Berlinerish Cherry from Celador Ales. And I had a bottle of Beauregard. It's a blueberry sour blonde from the brewery. It was good. It was also a manageable 6% or so. So not not your typical like aggressive barrel-aged sours and stuff and that fill some of the other parts of my fridge. And that was really it. So, yeah, not much. Oh, well. We'll get you back. Actually, probably get everybody back next week. I know if you're feeling better, I'm actually headed down to the brewery in Orange County on Sunday, so I should have some more things to report.
Yeah, I definitely had some stuff this weekend. It just wasn't anything exciting. So, yeah, we'll definitely check back in. We almost got blank probably for the first time in the history of this podcast, which would have been bad. I'm glad you saved us with a couple of some Monkish stuff.
I do what I can. Dan, one conversation, this is something I might dive into in an article. One conversation I was seeing about going forward on fourth down on Tuesday, David Hale brought it up and mentioned that SU has gone for it more than any other team, gone for it 21 times. That's three more than the nearest team, which I think is UMass. Strangely, we've converted, I think, 62% of our tries this year. I was going to look and see how many of those subsequent drives by opponents resulted in points or not, just to see if there was any sort of correlation there, versus also how many times did we convert on a fourth down and then proceed to score points. One would assume a lot of the time, since you're usually doing it inside the opponent's 40, but alas, I'll be able to get more on that when I write all this out. Dan, do you feel like going for it even more on fourth down this year has made this offense more interesting, or do you think it almost adds some sort of like ease of failure in a bad way because we're always looking at a four down situation once we get past the 50, and that can sometimes lead to wasted plays like a few instances we saw on Saturday?
I like it overall. I mean, I'm always one to kind of go with the more aggressive style and playing it by the numbers, which I think going for it on fourth down more than the average coach, you're almost always playing into what the numbers tell you should do because the vast majority of college football coaches are super, super conservative. So I'm into it. I think especially also when you're Syracuse, I think you have to kind of play with play above your means a little bit, especially against teams like coming up, and it's Clemson and Florida State and teams that have more talent, and not waste opportunities and not waste scoring potential on drives that are, you know, near the end zone, especially when obviously the kicking numbers I think are better than we let on, but I'm still nervous every time Murphy attempts a field goal. So I'm totally fine with it. There have been a couple spots where I've questioned the decisions, but usually I'm all in on Babers going for it. And honestly, like, even when I thought it was risky, like, I'm fine with just trusting his personal process on when he decides to go for it. Like, I think you have to kind of stick to your guns with some of these things.
Oh yeah, like I'm not doubting it at all. I'm a big fan of fourth down stuff, but I did notice a little, and you and I talked about it on Twitter in real time during the game, was that one sequence. And granted, it ended up the one where it was like third and seven, and then we just ran it like up the gut, knowing we weren't going to gain more than 3 yards. And it made sense if you were going for it on fourth down, but then they didn't. They went for a field goal. But as I mentioned in the play calling article, the one plus there was that we ended up having Pitt burn a timeout, which potentially pretty important later in the game.
Yeah, that was a weird spot. I was like 95% sure we were going for it on fourth, in which case like setting up the slightly easier opportunity made some sense, even though I didn't like the play call on third. So that one definitely confused me. I thought that that was obviously what we were doing, and then instead we took the three, and it worked out. We ended up winning the game, but that whole series kind of annoyed me.
Yeah. But honestly, like, if I haven't kept track of it, but I feel like Babers is getting people to burn timeouts at a reasonable clip. Like, I feel like it's almost won a game now, and just because we wait till the last second to bring out a punting unit, bring out a field goal unit, you know, we don't really give our hand until about the 15-second mark. And, like, no, it doesn't seem like it in real time, and especially in the first half, it doesn't really matter. But in the second half, like, it is a kind of savvy move, especially if you make the field goal after the timeout, that, like, you do potentially alter the game later. And like I said, we'll never really know if it would have been altered or not. But he did kind of change a little bit of what Narduzzi would have had to work with.
Yeah, it ended up working out for that reason. And obviously Pitt, like, not having the timeout at the end of the game was huge, considering he then had to burn a redshirt for his third-string quarterback for no reason to attempt a Hail Mary that was never going to work. So
I don't mind that. Not because of the act of doing it, but because of the fact that, what's-his-face, Brown's going to be out a couple weeks. And if I'm banking on somebody to be the future of the program, whether it's Pickett or DiNucci, I'm probably going with Pickett.
Yeah, I think at the time, I wasn't sure. I don't think we knew the extent of Brown's injury.
Right.
It's still kind of a weird spot because, I don't know. I think if he's going to be your second stringer, and assuming they're not, like, married to DiNucci, it sounds like they'll probably have played him anyway, then I definitely get it. At the time, it seemed pretty flummoxing. But overall, I think it ended up working out in Babers' favor, the decision, because it forced that timeout. Because I'm sure that Narduzzi, you know, he's watched the film, like, I think he probably thought it was pretty certain that Babers was under for it as well.
100%. And, like, it is interesting too, like if Pickett had actually, like, if Pickett becomes the starter, like, in short order, then it's fine. I mean, we've seen this ourselves where it was, you know, 2015, and Terrell Hunt gets injured early in the first quarter, and you, me, and everybody else thought that Eric Dungy was redshirting, 100% redshirting. And Dungy suddenly, like, you know, leaps the pile a little bit, gets ahead of a guy like Austin Wilson, who we all just kind of assumed was the next guy up. And then here we are, you know, 3 years later, and Dungy's well on his way to setting every school pass record for the most part. Like, so you never know. I mean, if Pickett's the starter within the next 2 weeks or so, potentially this all ends up working out for everybody except for Max Brown and Ben DiNucci.
Yeah, and there's, like, always a long-standing debate over, like, if the move is to play your quarterbacks right away, especially at the NFL level now. It's like, do you play the quarterbacks right away, or do you save them on the bench and try to develop them from afar? And then, obviously, the timeline's quite, you know, much faster in college because you try to get the most out of your guys in 4 years, 4 or 5 years. I think at this point in the season with Pitt, like, considering I don't think Pitt's still really going anywhere. I'm not sure what the rest of their schedule looks like, but what, they're 2-4. And
they have most of the ACC left.
Yeah, and then even, like, Virginia looks better than they do, and Duke looks better than they do. I think now you probably go with the young guy. Obviously, with Syracuse a couple years ago, Dungy was in, what, the second drive of the team?
Yeah.
And we had heard some, like, whispers about Dungy looking pretty good in preseason, so it wasn't too shocking that he got the nod at that point when it looked like, you know, Hump might be out for a while. So, yeah, I think at this point with Pitt, like, you see what you have, because the stakes aren't all that high for them, and I don't think Narduzzi's coaching for his job or anything.
No.
But in another one, then, you know, we've seen, like, I remember Red Robinson would burn red shirts at really weird times, not with quarterbacks, but...
just in general.
Yeah, just as a general rule, like, he just brought people, he'd, like, bring players in game, like, six in the fourth quarter, and... then, like, played them sporadically, or with Antoine Bailey, ended up working out because he beat Notre Dame because of it, but he burned his redshirt in the Louisville game, and he ended up having a nice game, but it was, like, I think it was, like, mid to late October by that point. So, yeah, you definitely want to be cautious with it because that fifth year can be very valuable, but at the same time, if you have a really good quarterback, like, there's a good chance it won't last that long, and there are obviously a lot of them transfer now, so there are definitely a lot of more things to take into account now than even there were, you know, 6 years ago when the transfer market wasn't what it was, and players, you know, still seem to come out a little earlier now, even when there isn't a guarantee of them being a high draft pick. So it's an interesting, like, alchemy in terms of deciding when to play a quarterback, or any player really, but quarterback especially, because there's, you know, such limited snaps for when you have multiple guys on the team. But yeah, overall, like, if this ends up being, you know, a half season tryout for, I'm trying to remember the player's name.
Pickett?
Set it up. Yes, for Pickett. Then it could end up working out. I still think, like, making his first attempt, a Hail right. Mary from the 17-yard line or whatever it was still a bit strange. But it definitely is more defensible when he's going to play down the stretch here.
Oh, yeah. And, I mean, admittedly, just focus back on us, like, I feel like we had a long history of strange shirts getting burned. In particular, I do feel like the last 2 years have had some weird shirts getting burned for Babers. What's his name? Scherzinger getting his burned in the first game. And I doubt we're going to see him again this year. It was kind of weird.
Yeah, he hasn't been playing specials, really, has he?
No, I have yet to see him on the field. I mean, I could be wrong. I'm not paying as much attention to specials as I am to offense, but... I haven't seen him. I know last year, I feel like we burned some shirts that I was confused by at the time. I mean, my thing is too, like, if we're not going to use Pierre, we're not going to use Scherzinger, it seems difficult to see why we would have burned the shirts early. I mean, maybe Baber sees more in the 2018 backs than them right now. And so potentially we could be looking at a situation where Scherzinger and Pierre redshirt next year, and then the new guys can come right in, and then there's like an actual battle once, you know, I assume Strickland moves to receiver or graduates after next year, and then, you know, Neil probably moves to receiver well before he graduates, like... I feel like there's also like internal workings that we don't know about from Babers, and obviously we wouldn't. But yeah, it is a weird. It's not the weirdest redshirting I've ever seen, but there are a couple like questions, and we're definitely gonna be faced with a little bit of a backlog. I know, especially at the running back position next year, based on what's on the roster and who we have and who's played already, which is everybody. And kind of, you know, where other guys can slot in.
Yeah, I mean, we've been facing, like, kind of an uphill battle in that regard for years now. I don't really remember the last time we had, like, a really fully fleshed-out number situation. Maybe towards the end of Marone we were getting there, but it's been kind of a constant issue. I think, overall, like, there have been some confusing red shirts, but I do think it's been better under Babers than even it was under the last couple administrations, so... hopefully we get to a place where we don't need to worry about like blowing random people for, you know, one-off snaps in early season games and never using them again. I really don't know what the situations were earlier this year, because those are pretty questionable, but I don't think Baber's really been asked about that, has he? Hopefully someone can.
I doubt it. I doubt he'd answer it even if you did ask him.
That's fair. Yeah. It's hard to get answers.
I think everybody's noticed that with him, that like, as good as Babers is, I think he's also like, and Sean noticed this early on too, like Babers understands the media's role, but is never going to bring them in too close. And like, he doesn't play the game. If he doesn't want to answer a question, he just mows right through it.
He's way better about being like polite about it. Yeah. And he's not all that confrontational most of the time with the media, but yeah, it's, He doesn't give you a lot. He's good about finding a way to make it seem like he's giving you something, and then you listen back to you, you're like, oh, that was nothing.
Yeah, that was. Well, I've noticed too, like some of the guys on Twitter, especially like the Syracuse.com guys, like some national folks are like, oh man, like, you know, Dino Babers is up at the mic like on teleconference, and like Carlson and some of the other guys are like, wait, what? Like, this is literally like, he literally has said nothing for weeks now.
He's done it anecdotes, and he's done it like little stories that have nothing to do with the team. And he gives you interesting stuff there. Not so much with like actual like hard info outside of like what he wants to reveal. So I guess he's doing his job well. It's better than I'd say Schaefer was, where he was just very antagonistic, or Marone, who looked like he wanted to just die every single time he spoke to the media, aside from his opening presser. I don't remember enough of Robinson's interactions to weigh in with him, but I don't think anything could have mattered.
No.
But yeah, he's still a coach at the end of the day.
True, true. So I guess getting back to Clemson specific stuff, in today's injury report, not only are Josh Black and Kendall Coleman doubtful, but Shaq Gross-Fenor is also doubtful. I don't know where that even came from because I didn't remember him getting injured at all. That's not good because we already had like zero depth on the defensive line and now we have even less. The good thing is that Jake Picard is probable. I don't know how effective a defensive end who hasn't played in over a year is going to be in his first game back against a team like Clemson, but it's very likely that we see Picard quite a bit, again, given the depth issues. On the other side of things, Kelly Bryant will play. I think he'll be fine from a throwing perspective, but I am very curious, Dan, about how mobile he's actually going to be able to be compared to what he usually does. And he's run for even more yardage than Dungy has at this juncture.
That's his game is running the ball. He's a decent thrower, but overall, like, he's going to beat with his legs, and he's not super, super accurate. They're definitely better off for having him, especially because the guys behind him are not very experienced. Basically, the options were Eric Cooper, who has had some cups of water here and there, but not any, like, extended playing time, and then Hunter Johnson, who played a lot of the Wake Forest game after Bryant went out, and he threw for his first touchdown.
Johnson would worry me, though. Like, even though Syracuse can't stop mobile quarterbacks. We saw that against DiNucci last week. Like, we still don't know how to defend them. So, like, if Bryant's 100% healthy, like, I'm worried about that. But I'd be much more worried from a throwing perspective. Like, I saw Hunter Johnson throw at Elite 11 last year. And, like, I've seen what he did even in limited time against Wake. Like, he's a five-star quarterback and the type of guy who could shred this defense and make them look like, you know, the last few years' secondaries.
Yeah, and he was the number one quarterback in the country for a reason. So, but, you know, I think you take your chances with the guy making his first start, not that he doesn't have the tools to beat us. But overall, I think they'll probably be very happy to have Bryant back because he's looked quite good, especially following up a guy like Watson. He doesn't make a ton of huge mistakes. He gets first downs, and he gets the ball into the hands of Clemson's playmakers, who are, you know, numerous and deadly.
And yet their numbers aren't that great. I think that's largely because they've just put teams away on the defensive side of the ball. I was just looking, like, doing some research earlier today, just to, like, see, like, I mean, I know the names and, like, guys like Deion Kane and stuff like that, like, but you're not seeing the gaudy numbers that maybe people were used to. I think, like, Clemson's actually come off in recent years. Like, since Chad Morris left, the offense still has pace, the offense still has explosiveness, but you're not seeing, like, the gaudy individual numbers for these guys that you were seeing under Morris.
Yeah, I think some of that is that they really do, like, kind of park the bus, for lack of a better term, when they get up big, because the defense just clamps down on people and Clemson does kind of takes the gas off a little bit earlier than some other teams. They're not like Alabama, who seems determined to score 60 on every like lesser SEC team that it can, even though I don't really know what it's trying to back up them for.
Existing, I would assume. There's that option, the option that that Nick Saban wishes people would stop hiring his assistants. That would be another potential thing he's looking for retribution for. I'm sure Nick Saban does not like having to hire new people. So it's probably that he's just so angry that now he has to go hire new people. That he just gets really, really pissed off and everyone's got to pay for it.
Nick Saban just hates talking to people it's other coaches that might have to join his staff. Like, he just resents human contact. And I guess that's where this stems from. Like you said, just why would you make him, you know, interview a new linebacker coach?
Although oddly, he looks like he really enjoys himself. Like when they put him in the like when he's in like a studio segment, or like when they bring him in like during a big game, like for like a halftime show. Like he seems like he loves that shit.
Yeah, in that case, like he's doing something a little different. I just think he hates like having to answer questions mid game and the press conferences. He might secretly actually, like, kind of enjoy being so antagonistic at, like, the press conferences, but I don't know. He just, he's an interesting one. He's just so, like, he just shows so little emotion, even compared to, like, Boeheim was kind of the same shtick, but Boeheim just looks exhausted. Saban's just so stone-faced all the time, it's kind of remarkable.
Yeah, that's. I don't think anyone will ever figure him out. Before we finish up, one other thing, because I know we talked about the Clemson offense a little bit. On defense, there's a lot of players we could be concerned about. Is there one more than the others that you are very, very concerned about?
I'd say Kane is probably the obvious answer, just because he's been there for a while and he's, you know, a proven playmaker. Is it Travis Etienne, the young running back who is starting to kind of make a dent on this offense? It's not like the go-to running back quite yet, but actually he is. All right, no, Feaster's still out snapping him or out touching him, but he has 378 yards on 46 carries. He's just behind Bryant in terms of actual rushing yards. He scored 5 times. A lot of those have been late in games, but he's just an absolute burner in open field. He's a true freshman. He's just one of those guys that it's like a total mismatch once he gets to the second level. So he's pretty scary. But then, you know, the receivers are just, they just have a really solid core. Like, none of the guys are, like you said, they're not killing it stat-wise, but Ray-Ray McCloud, Hunter Renfrow, the, you know, Alabama killer, and Deion Kane, all having nice years, and they can all take the top off of defense. Renfrow is just really annoying because he converts first downs at, like, a stupid rate.
Look forward to seeing him on the Patriots next year.
Oh, God, yeah. He's built to fill that role. So yeah, they can spread the ball around a lot. They have an improving running game, and it's weird to say that because they're averaging over 5 yards a carry, and like a competent passing game that can probably rise to the occasion. It just hasn't really had to yet. So I'm not really looking forward to this matchup. I think their offense is plenty good to score some points on the Syracuse team.
Yeah, I agree. If there's any player in the offense that's going to beat us, I think it's going to be Kane. You know, he's really their deep threat. Obviously SU has some trouble at least once or twice a game connecting because Pitt sucks. They couldn't connect deep the couple of opportunities they have. We also had some really nice plays made by Scoop Bradshaw and Chris Frederick, but I would expect one or two deep balls to go the other way, unfortunately. On the other side, there's a lot of players to get worried about. I would be most worried about Austin Bryant at defensive end probably. And then obviously Kendall Joseph's a big name and the type of guy who is incredibly disruptive. But Bryant scares me the most, if only because he doesn't just create havoc in the pass game with 5 sacks, but he has 11.5 tackles for loss. Definitely just a horrifying player to have to guard against, especially for our line, which has not really proven it can do much well. I mean, it definitely got better in the second half last week, but Jamar McGloster, unfortunately, is not going to be your go-to guy against a top pass rusher. They'll probably find ways to exploit that, whether it's with Bryant or somebody else. Cody Conway's our best offensive lineman right now, but he also does make some mistakes here and there. That comes with youth. And he's not even that young, but in general, comes with youth. So I do feel like we're going to be susceptible here. I hope we don't end up being victims of, like, you know, 7 or 8 sacks plus, like some teams seem to be against Clemson.
Yeah, I'm worried about their internal defensive line. Christian Wilkins and Dexter Lawrence are probably the best defensive tackle combo in a long time. Wilkins plays a little more all over the place, but Lawrence, like, stuffs the middle. They're both really nasty. And they both, especially Wilkins, can kind of get after the passer more than your average interior lineman. I don't think that they're going to have any problem stuffing the Syracuse run game. They do that to everyone. But the fact that they're going to render us completely one-dimensional, even more so than most teams are able to just by default, means I'm a little bit worried that we're going to see a lot of Dungy having to escape the pocket really quickly because you have guys like Wilkins and Lawrence coming free from the middle. And when you start an interior pass rush like that, it makes it very, very difficult to cope with a defensive line.
Yeah, I mean, we saw a little bit last week, to be honest, like the moments when Pitt actually got a push. There were some gaping holes in the middle of that line. Obviously, you know, like guys like, you know, Evan Adams and Cervais and some of the other guys that we've used to plug, you know, the middle of that line. Like, it's just... it's not going to be enough against Clemson. So that probably means, you know, and we did this against LSU, pulling in an extra blocker. So whether that's Strickland or Elmore or Ravian Pierce, like there's probably going to be an extra blocker in there that probably limits what Eric Dungy can do in the backfield as far as, you know, movement, because then you have to rely on the blocker to really move with you and get out of your way. And Dungy's not someone to really wait for anybody to do that. He's just someone who's going to be able to take off. I mean, at the same time, like NC State applied a ton of pressure on us, but it was the early pressure that really got to us, not the later pressure. Dungy was able to kind of exploit some of that later pressure, and he did it against Pitt as well. I'd say NC State is the more comparable team here, obviously, than Pitt is on that front with regard to Clemson. But I think if SU wants to go one-dimensional, I think they'll find some success. I just don't think it's going to be enough to win.
Yeah, ultimately, like, they have one of the best defenses, maybe the best defense in the country. Venables is an awesome coordinator. Like, I just don't think a team with the inability to get any kind of run game is going to put much of a, you know, a dent in this Clemson defense. I think maybe we'll steal a touchdown late, and we'll probably not end up shut out because we do have some ability here. But overall, I don't think that we're ever going to really threaten.
Fair enough. Dan, give me a final score.
I'm going to go, I'll go 38-14.
All right. I'm going to go 31-17 Clemson. So Syracuse would cover.
Yeah, I think I would be just, what is it, 22-point spread still. So, yeah, I'd be a little outside, a little outside the cover there margin.
Well, SU is 3-1-1 against the spread this year, the one loss being Middle Tennessee. They've covered sizable margins against LSU and NC State. I do have some faith, and even Clemson fans that I've talked to seem to have some faith that SU is going to be able to cover in this one, just because of Clemson's habit of just kind of coasting through the second half because the game's already won. So who knows?
Yeah, I think the one saving grace there, if you were looking for SU to keep this one close, is we've played them close at the Dome. I think last time we played them at the Dome, it was one of the weird Mahoney games. But also, I feel like Clemson's had the spot against BC on the Friday night the last couple times on the road, and
it always gets
they don't always come out firing on Friday nights on the road. It's a weird spot, and Syracuse has played well in that spot occasionally. So
yeah, used to at least once a season. The Friday nights at the Dome was definitely a thing during Marone.
Yes, the West Virginia game,
the USF game,
the USF game,
the UConn game.
Yeah, if you want to play into, like, weird time, weird day, lack of motivation for Clemson, which is kind of rolling along, then I think on paper Clemson should be able to cover. I think the external things probably favor Syracuse keeping it a little closer, which is all to say that, like, I could see this going in any of these possible directions. I don't think Syracuse will keep this one within a touchdown, but if you told me they only lost by two touchdowns and Clemson looked really sloppy, I would believe you.
As would I. All right, Dan, is there anything else you wanted to add before we kind of sign off for the week?
Nope. Hopefully we have a fun game to watch, and we can kind of get on people's radars. Even if, you know, being on Friday night on ESPN, like, even if Syracuse doesn't win, like, looking competitive could, you know, raise a couple eyebrows here and there. Not enough to then don't lose your next three games, but if we could keep this one close and then, you know, maybe look good against Miami. I think it's Miami the week after, right?
Yeah.
We have Miami or Florida State. Yeah, then maybe we can start to down some radars here. But obviously, winning does a lot more than that. I'm not going to foist, like, crazy expectations here. So hopefully we get a good performance and look like we belong in the same field, which is not always the case when we play these kinds of games.
Too true. I would echo all of those thoughts. That was Dan. I'm John. Thank you, everybody, for listening to Troy Noon's An Absolute Podcast. Be sure to rate, review, subscribe on iTunes, on Blog Talk, wherever else you listen to podcasts, and go Orange.
Go Orange.